This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. President Trump discussing the relationship with Kim Jong-un, the progress that was made at the summit, that they have a framework for denuclearization. Yesterday, we talked about his sit-down with Clinton Foundation donor Zero. Today, per an interview he did on Air Force One yesterday with Brett Baer, he built upon that by talking more specifically about his confidence that he's serious, of course, but that his confidence that Kim Jong-un is serious about denuclearization.
This should have been done 10 years, 15, 20 years ago. This shouldn't be done now where they have an arsenal of nuclear weapons. This should have never allowed to get to this point. With that being said, Chairman Kim wants to resolve the problem because he knew that we weren't playing around. I wasn't playing around. He's not playing around. We have a very, I really say, for a fairly short-term relationship, because it was unbelievably hostile, the rhetoric. Rhetorically, it was unbelievably hostile. And I think we have a very good relationship. We understand each other.
Is his confidence misplaced? Or does he have a third-eye insight into one Kim Jong-un? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Michael Rubin, resident scholar for the American Enterprise Institute, author of a number of books, including Dancing with the Devil and Kurdistan Rising. Former Pentagon official. Michael, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dan. Thanks for having me, Amy.
Our pleasure. And so what's your take, I should say, in response to Trump's confidence in Kim Jong-un?
You know, call me dubious. And the reason I'm dubious is if we look back over the history of negotiations with North Korea, we have a pattern where it becomes very easy to come to declarative statements that we want denuclearization. The problem is what that means. And when we start negotiating into the details, that's when it all falls apart. Donald Trump isn't orthodox. He thinks outside the box, and that can be a good thing. But in effect, what he's done with the summit is do things in reverse, where he gives the big high-profile meeting first, and then figures, well, we can just deal with all the details later. In the past, when we've tried to get to all the details, again, things just haven't worked out the way we thought.
Well, Mike Pompeo, was in South Korea. Now he's in China this morning. But he, you know, said yesterday verification is going to be required and that there has to be denuclearization before those sanctions are lifted. Do you trust in that process?
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of Mike Pompeo. And the thing which Donald Trump is doing differently is that he's not giving a bunch of incentives up front, at least financial incentives up front, and that's a very positive thing because oftentimes North Korea, and this is a common issue with rogue regimes in general, are much more interested in the process because they can get a lot of money during the process rather than coming to the ultimate conclusion to make that decision for peace. So as far as that goes, that's important. But also remember, this isn't the first time that North Korea has supposedly promised denuclearization. Under the George H.W. Bush administration, Brent Scowcroft negotiated a denuclearization deal on the Korean Peninsula. Kim's grandfather signed off on that, and it ended up going nowhere.
Right. I mean, we've been on this merry-go-round before, there's no question, or been on this merry-go-round for the past 35 years. The two areas where Trump has received some criticism from the left and the right, get your take on. One is some of his arguably overly complimentary rhetoric in the direction of Kim Jong-un, who's a dictator and a thug. And number two, announcing the suspension of war games, whether it did or did not catch the Pentagon off guard, the substance of suspending those war games, offering a concession where all they have from Kim Jong-un is a statement of principle. What do you say to those criticisms?
You know, I join in both of those criticisms. One of the more interesting things about the summit was the slick 4-minute Hollywood produced video, which Donald Trump presented to Kim, which basically gave a vision of what North Korea would be like if North Korea makes the decision to join the rest of the world. And it basically showed North Korea transforming from what it is now into sort of like a Miami Beach. And in fact, I think they used the skyline of Miami Beach in the video. Now, the point of this is there's a reason why Miami Beach developed the way it did, whereas Cuba and Nicaragua didn't.
Yeah.
And it's because of freedom. It's because of liberty. We've tried, and this is what I don't think Trump mentioned, is we've tried to sort of build up the tourist industry in the past. When I say we, I mean South Korea. In 1998, I believe it was, they created a tourist zone, and a million South Koreans flocked to this tourist zone at a mountain about 30 miles north of the DMZ, and that all came screeching to a halt when a South Korean woman strayed off a walking path and was shot dead by a North Korean soldier. The point of this is, if you're not going to address basic issues of human rights and freedom, you're not going to be able to develop North Korea the way Donald Trump outlined in his vision.
Why hasn't President Trump been, you know, stronger about denouncing, you know, the oppression of the people under the Kim Jong-un regime?
I think for Donald Trump, it's just philosophical in this case that he sees it as an impediment to other issues, and he sees it as an infringement on the sovereignty of North Korea. He wants to reinforce this notion that we are not going to infringe on the sovereignty of North Korea. I mean, there's a logic there. It happens to be a logic with which I disagree.
Yeah, and I mean, part of it is, even if you can see the logic of it, because he has obviously spoken in no uncertain terms about North Korea previously, thinking about Otto Warmbier's murder and a release, and then, of course, his death shortly thereafter. And so Rocket Man, he's ridiculed the Kim Jong-un and the regime. So it's not like it's all been namby-pamby rhetoric from Trump, but during this phase of the relationship, it just seems to me, even if you want to tamp down some of the heated rhetoric for the purposes of advancing the larger goal of denuclearization, okay, fine. But he's just taking it a little too far for my taste when he talks about Kim Jong-un being a tough guy, you know, only 1 in 10,000 people could do what Kim Jong-un's done in North Korea. I don't know. There's a lot of people who would be thugs if they were given totalitarian power from their father. It doesn't seem like a big accomplishment to me. I just think it's been a little bit too much, even if you concede the point that you should round off the edges with some of the rhetoric.
No, I absolutely agree. And while it's cheap to bring up World War II, Nazi rhetoric, and so forth, human rights organizations regularly say that the concentration camps which exist in North Korea are actually worse than what existed in Germany during World War II. They exist for different purposes, but the end results are the same. And it's just a level of repression that I don't think many, many Americans can even envision. And when you look at the North Korean philosophy with regard to this, if you are deemed politically disloyal, and that could be a result of, for example, not crying sufficiently when the late leader is mentioned, not only are you condemned, but three generations of your family are condemned. It's hard to imagine a regime that upholds those values somehow joining and interacting with the rest of the world.
Do you think the people of North Korea even know what's going on? I mean, do they have access to the information that President Trump has met with Kim Jong-un?
Well, for a while, it was actually interesting because while there was vague mention that there was going to be a meeting, it was only a day before the meeting occurred that the North Korean media mentioned that, yes, there would be a meeting, it would be in Singapore, and so forth. But, you know, in North Korea, there's really two North Koreas. There's Pyongyang, which is the capital, which only the elite and screened loyalists can live in. And then there's the rest of the countryside. And I don't think that the rest of the countryside is really aware of what's going on here. But that's another issue. If North Korea is serious about peace, after generations of propaganda demonizing the United States, they've got to start preparing their public. And that's actually the sign that I'd be looking for. And the fact that I don't see it, Amy, is what worries me deeply.
How do you think Beijing and Moscow are receiving the summit and Trump's characterizations of it subsequent to it?
You know, Beijing looks, let me put it this way. North Korea is to Beijing what Hezbollah is to Iran. And therefore, Beijing feels that no matter what happens, they're going to be in the driver's seat. They're going to be able to benefit. from Beijing's standpoint, a legitimization of North Korea would probably be a good thing. At the same time, what Communist China is most obsessed with is Japan. And when we talk about South Korea embracing this sort of process and so forth, the only regional country which has been urging caution is Japan. So really, the U.S. ally Japan is the outlier here. With regard to Russia, you know, I'm going to put that on hold because while Russia does share a tiny border with North Korea, China is really the elephant in the room here.
And what about Syria? I mean, President Assad met with Kim Jong-un 2 weeks ago.
Well, that really just kind of shows where Syria is. For all the talk about Bashar al-Assad being a Western-educated doctor, perhaps he can bring stability. He's an anti-Islamist and so forth. Sometimes a rogue is just a rogue. And this is what we see repeatedly, that we can always pretend with diplomacy that rogue leaders can somehow change, but ultimately the only time you get a regime actually changing is when that rogue leader steps down.
How do you react to the Nobel talk, you know, for Rodman, of course, but also for President Trump?
You know, I tend to find it ridiculous, but this isn't a thing against Donald Trump. My problem with the Nobel Peace Prize is the Nobel Peace Prize is awarded differently than all the other Nobels. All the other Nobels are awarded from Sweden and usually from a panel of experts. The Nobel Peace Prize is awarded in Norway, and it's from a panel of politicians. While all the other Nobel Prizes look at a life's work, a life's record of work, the Nobel Peace Prize tends to be aspirational. Just look at the award for Barack Obama.
Right.
No one actually wants to see 30 years later whether that peace worked. They're voting on hope, and too often that hope goes unrealized. I kind of think, as with many politicians and things that politicians touch, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee is a bit ridiculous.
I understand also Barack Obama is under consideration for another Nobel for his forthcoming Netflix shows. So,
I mean, maybe for literature, maybe for poetry, who knows?
Could be a two-time winner.
Could
be a two-time winner. Speaking of the Obama administration, Ben Rhodes' new book, it's interesting, kind of outing some of the behind the scenes of Obama foreign policy decision making, most notably recently this week, the red line, and how that red line and defending the red line or not defending the red line in Syria that Obama rhetorically drew, how that went down. And it was interesting because Rhodes essentially characterized the President Obama as looking for a way to not defend the red line. And so the way that he found was to go seek congressional authorization to do so, knowing he wouldn't get it, so he didn't have to do anything about the marker that he put down.
You know, it's kind of interesting because there's a pattern here. When it came, for example, to withdrawing the U.S. forces from Iraq, the big issue that you may remember was we wanted the Iraqi parliament to grant our troops immunity when Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki refused to send this to the parliament, we walked away. Now, what's oftentimes not told in that story is before we raised our demand that immunity be voted upon by the Iraqi parliament, as an executive authority, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki had agreed to allow U.S. troops to stay, and then we came back and added this extra condition. Maliki had complained to me shortly after the time in a meeting I had with him that the United States won't take yes for an answer. And so we see this continued pattern where we keep doing things that we know are going to end in rejection and then use that as an excuse, A, to not do them, and B, to have an excuse to sort of divert responsibility for that decision away from us as a person, in this case, Obama. And to me, that's basically an affront to leadership on two different levels. Number one, you know you're doing the wrong thing. Number two, you don't want to bear personal responsibility for it.
And the other example is, which has been, I guess, unsurprisingly underreported in D.C., is the Iranian deal and the Obama administration lying to Congress about what they were doing with respect to releasing funds to the Iranian regime and trying to get U.S. banks to violate the law, to violate the law in terms of converting currency for the Iranians. The U.S. banks wouldn't do it, but that doesn't obviate the effort by the Obama administration to cover their lie to Congress with trying to get U.S. banks to violate the law.
No, you're absolutely right, Dan. And as you know, I testified in Congress in the House Oversight Committee on this last week. The fact of the matter is, the deeper we go into this, the more just legally and constitutionally disgusting it becomes. When people walked away, when Donald Trump walked away from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, people made it seem like this huge thing, the turning our back on the law, turning our back on the international system. But it was Julia Freifeld, Secretary of State John Kerry under Obama's Assistant Secretary for Legislative Affairs, who actually sent a note to then Congressman Mike Pompeo saying, hey, look, not only is this agreement unsigned, but it's not a treaty, it's not an executive agreement, it's just a political agreement, and part of that political, so it's weak. Part of that political agreement, however, was that when it passed Congress, that all these side deals would be given to Congress as a condition of congressional approval. And what we found out is, frankly, the Obama administration lied. And frankly, it's getting more serious because the Obama administration lied during hearings to Congress. And so the House Oversight Committee would be within its right to call some of these officials back, even though they're not out of office, because they lied directly under oath to Congress.
He is Michael Rubin, resident scholar for the American Enterprise Institute, the author of a number of books, including Dancing with the Devil and Kurdistan Rising. Michael, thanks for joining us. Always appreciate your insights.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dan and Amy.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.